Okay, well, thanks. So this morning I'll be telling you about some of our work on the evolutionary expansion of gene families involved in dominant disease. So in a sense, you know, trying to put it in the perspective of evolutionary cell biology, we're just interested in linking, if we can, you know, what happened in the cell or in an organism at rather short time scales, like the say cycle or up to the lifetime of an organism, up to very long evolutionary time scales. Here we are talking about hundreds of millions of years. And the surprising observation that we'll discuss is that you know, genes that are actually involved in specifically dominant disease, as we will see, have had their families or gene families really greatly expanding in eukaryotes, but more specifically in vertebrates, as we will discuss. So obviously you could tell me that you know, this is presumably not the reason what these families got expanded, because they are probably good for something else. And so maybe that's not the right way to look at this problem, just to look at disease. But actually, I will try to convince you that this is not as simple as that. It probably it's actually quite interesting to focus at disease to understand this expansion of gene families. So these are the players before I forget them. In particular, Param Priyasing, Sylvain Affelt, and Julia Malaguti. So if I wanted to be even more provocative, I could, you know, suggest that there are some genes that are dangerous somehow. So they are not bad, but they are dangerous in the sense that if you mutate them, you're likely to get into trouble, while other genes are not dangerous. So just to recap on this, obviously not all genes are equal, so again, mutations. There are typical mutations that don't do much, in fact, to genes, but when they do something, you're often likely to lose or lessen the function. And since we are diploids, if we are talking about diploid organisms, as long as you have a second functional allele, you're typically fine. Obviously, if you lose the two alleles, then you can be in trouble, and that's in particular what we call essential genes. You absolutely need at least one functional allele. So that's the typical case. But obviously, next to these rather typical genes, you also have other genes that will be prone to dominant mutations, and in particular, gain-of-function mutations. And that's the genes that I'd like to coin dangerous. It's just a name, so dangerous genes will be just genes prone to dominant deleterious mutations. And you can think of oncogenes, for instance, or as we will see, genes that have autoinhibitory domains are really the typical dangerous genes. And the surprise, as I alluded to at the beginning, is that these genes prone to dominant deleterious mutations, they have been really greatly expanded. These gene families have been greatly expanded by gene duplication in invertebrates. And to put this into numbers, if you compare typical invertebrate to typical vertebrate genomes, there are 20 or 50% more genes in typical vertebrates. But these gene families, they are really exploded, so to speak. I mean, they really have many more genes.
Sorry, can I ask you, so just because I know that this word dominant means different things to different people.
Okay.
So in the yeast world, right, it has a very precise meaning. Can you just say what you actually mean by a dominant mutation?
Well, here I would say, you know, mutations for which you have a deleterious effect, even if you just mutate one allele, one of the two copy of this gene on your genome when you are diploid. So that's really you know, related to diploid organisms.
Okay. That could be pro-dominant.
So what?
You're saying you're calling anything that isn't completely recessive dominant.
Yeah, I mean, then you can refine. No, I agree. You can definitely refine, but that's the
My sense is, from people who talk, use the word dominant in talking about diseases, that it's not that strict definition that you have one wild type, one mutant, and you see the phenotype. That the dominant, that's somehow wrapped up into your definition of what you call dominant, is that it actually has some huge deleterious effect on that organism. Is that not right? So yes. If you overexpress something and you end up with a severe disease phenotype, you would call that dominant, even though it doesn't fit that strict genetic definition of what.
Yeah. Well, here, I guess I would tend to focus on mutations, not on expression levels. But
okay.
No, I agree. I mean, this is. I mean, this is definitely not a slice for this audience, but just to make this into perspective, I just meant it in a very general
just
sense.
So we all understand.
Yes?
And why is it gain of function in that case? So basically what you're saying, dominant means if I just like change one, if I make one point mutation, then it's really dangerous. So then I guess.
Well, then I have an effect. So typically, you know, the mutation, if the mutation leads to a loss of function, then if the other copy is functional, typically you don't see much. Okay. Obviously, if the mutation makes this particular mutant having a so gain of function is not a new function. It's rather the level of activation of a gene. So, you know, you have these genes that are in, as we saw. A few days back, we saw these genes that can be in active or inactive form. So these genes, when you mutate them, they can become, 10 to 100 times more active. So really, I mean, obviously, if you have one allele that is a mutant like this, you have a constitutively active genes, and it doesn't help you to have a perfectly wild type next to it in your genome, it won't change. Okay?
I also asked the when you talk about the increase in dangerous genes from invertebrates to vertebrates, are you talking about, is that an increase in dangerous genes relative as a percentage of the total genes, or as a percentage of the increase? So for example, imagine you have, I don't know, 10,000 genes in an organism, and now you're looking at another organism that has that you have 10,000 single copy genes, you have no families, and you have a change and it goes from 10,000 to 11,000 genes, you're adding 1,000 genes. If that 1,000 genes is one family that is dangerous, right, you have this huge increase in dangerous genes, but it was only a single type. So if you ask of the increase from invertebrates to vertebrates, that if you throw out the genes that you can map one to one, is it that increase that is preferentially dangerous, or is it just an increase in the kinds of genes that increase are dangerous? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think everything is kind of related, but okay. So here I just mean in terms of number of genes. I mean just a rough number. As you said, if you start with the 10,000 genes, then you're likely to have 15,000 genes in vertebrates in that case. And then certain of these families, we'll see some examples. If you had just one gene representative for these families in vertebrates, you are likely to have maybe three copies in vertebrates. So it's really triple the number, the relative number of these.
The reason I ask also is that I'm curious whether you've looked beyond the invertebrate to vertebrate group. So it's true that at least among common model organisms, invertebrates have fewer genes than vertebrates. It's not necessarily true that vertebrates have fewer genes than other organisms, like microbial eukaryotes. There are some microbial eukaryotes that have 10 times
many more. That's clear.
And certainly, I hadn't really thought about this before, but as I've talked about previously, we've been very interested in gene families and expanded gene families, and I would, my belief, I can look at this in detail, is that in microbial eukaryotes, you also see that that the genes that tend to amplify as gene families are genes that you would class as dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that that's an invertebrate to vertebrate issue.
No.
May just be a function of when you expand your genome through duplication, that the genes that are prone to do that are likely to be what you would call dangerous genes, and we'll probably get into what the reasons for that might
be. Yeah, exactly. So I cannot say much about this because we haven't looked at it, but so the story will be focused on invertebrate to vertebrates, but in principle, as you will see, the underlying ideas might apply somewhere else, so maybe that would be great to discuss.
The example you're giving of a dangerous gene, the oncogenes.
Yeah.
In that case, oncogenes are genes which are policing the properties of cells, such as their replication and so on, and so they're involved in policing functions in the multicellular organism of the inherent properties of cells. And so if you mutate those genes, then you have a gain in function of unrestricted replication of cells, but it's really a loss of function of regulation. You're losing.
Sure. I mean, yeah. So I don't really want to, make a direct one-to-one connection. Obviously, you can have a dominant negative. I mean, that all that we know. This is, as I say, it's not a slice really for this audience, but more for people not to, well accustomed to basic genetics. But obviously, you can have subtleties.
I hate to prolong this, but even the last point there. What's the evidence of this? I mean, how do we have counts of dangerous genes?
Oh, I'll show you this. I mean, this is So I'll show you this. Okay. So at least, that's the first example. So it's just an example. But that's how really we got into this this field. And this is starting with a discussion with another group at Institut Curie, the group of Jacques Camonis, and. In this group, they study actually signaling pathways that is involved in cell proliferation, migration. So that's the RAS-RAL pathway, and they study it because it's actually involved in many cancers. But the interesting thing is that they study the same pathway both in human and in fly, and that's the two pathways. And as you can see, the typical invertebrate, typical vertebrate, there was a large expansion of some of these genes. So the blocks with the same color correspond to the duplicates. Obviously, as you can see already at the topology of this network, it has some impacts with some sort of bottleneck that appears because of these specific duplications that happened. But this is not really, we've studied this actually quite extensively, but this is not really what I will discuss today. I will really focus on gene families, not on network. And the striking observation, I think, that we realized starting to discuss with this group is that, in fact, essentially all these duplicates that you can see here, They were not duplicated independently from one another. They essentially all arose through two rounds of whole genome duplications that occur at the origin of vertebrates. Probably the only exception is this GEF, RAL-GEF gene that is probably specific to mammals. But all the other ones, basically, they just inherited them from the very early vertebrates. Yes?
That's good. There used to be lots of arguments about those duplications, and are they settled now?
I
just haven't kept track.
Yeah, so I think so. I will discuss this. I mean, I will show you some more evidence about this. So you're right. I mean, this whole genome duplication has been debated for since the early ages.
No.
Susumu Ono, so the late 60s, and it took I think almost 40 years. But I think now. Okay, maybe you'll disagree, but I think more and more people in the field tend to agree that there was such a duplication, and I'll show you some of the results that we obtained also, which definitely don't prove this, but definitely don't contradict this, so they are perfectly consistent with the whole genome duplication.
I'm going to talk about this, but one striking thing there is, it's just one exception.
Yeah.
Is it typical for the, so if there were two whole genome duplications,
yes,
and there's the opportunity to have multiple copies of everybody, but
yeah,
your pathway, there's no duplicates at the bottom step.
Right.
There's one pair at the second step.
Exactly.
Three at the next one, and five. Is this common? That the higher up in a pathway you are, the more duplicates you retain?
This I can't tell. We haven't looked at this. Again, we didn't really yet look at the connection of networks and these gene families, but there are certainly interesting things to look at. Right, so here in this example, so obviously, since there was this genome duplication, everybody got duplicated at some point, and what happened is that typically after whole genome duplication, most of these duplicates are lost over time. So it takes 10 to 100 million years, but eventually you lose them. And so that's what happened for those genes, obviously. And here, you know, for this one, this RAL, so that's a RAS-like gene, we retain two of the possible four copies. This GEF here retain all four of its copies. And the striking thing, and we'll come back to that, is that these are precisely these GEFs that are the most dangerous, because when you mutate them, they just permanently activate these signaling pathways that control cell proliferation and so on. So that's really the genes that are mutated in cancer.
Is that now five copies?
This is fine. So there was one extra copy, which doesn't come from whole genome duplication. It's a more recent copy. But as you see, I mean, they're all there. So this is really striking, and I'll come back to that. Because, you know, you have to realize that 90% of the copies are lost after whole genome duplications. About half of the human genome has small-scale duplicates, and here you have none. So this is a very, very striking result. I'll come back. So just a few words about this whole genome duplication. So the whole genome duplication we're talking about are those. So they are arguably the most ancient, or in any case, very ancient whole genome duplications, about 500 million years. That leads to the whole radiation of vertebrates. But as you can see, so that's the eukaryotic tree of life. In fact, all major branches of eukaryotes had some, typically several rounds of whole genome duplication. So if you take typical eukaryotes, you may well expect that in its descendants there was such dramatic whole genome duplication events.
That's right. All branches, but not all organisms.
Well, all organisms come from a branch, and so in this branch, I think it's a rather reasonable assumption to assume that any eukaryotes had in its descendants or in its ancestor rather some whole genome duplications. So you see, for instance, plants have done many of those. The paramecium have done also a number, although here I should apologize, maybe we should discuss, because they are probably more ancient than this. Actually, at the beginning, so these slides I just updated, I started 10 years ago or so, and then from time to time I add a new whole genome duplication as they are reported in the literature. So initially I actually spread those three whole genome duplications, and then I actually found a review that had them, I spread them because there was no information basically, and then a review suggested that they were much more recent, but when we discussed with Mike a few days ago, they are probably not that recent. So I should...
We can talk about that. I mean, there's been some work on that in the group, the larger group, say the chromalveolates or whatever, that certainly there have been duplications in the ciliates. There are many other lineages and where there may or may not have been.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely...
And if you wanted to complete this, probably this... I mean, certainly the lineages where whole genome duplications have been most extensively studied are in the fungi. I mean, much more so, I think, than in metazoa.
Yeah.
And there have been many cases of whole genome duplications in many different fungal lineages.
Yes, yes, no, definitely. So, I mean, I should probably update this even more, but then... So
I'm not saying that you need to do that.
I know.
I wouldn't dispute your argument that most and possibly all eukaryotes have a whole genome in duplication somewhere in their ancient history.
Yeah. I think that's a fair assumption. It might be wrong, but you're more likely right than wrong when you assume that. okay, and for instance, another example, so fish. Essentially, 90% of fish nowadays all come from a single species that underwent a third whole genome duplication after these two about 300 million years ago. And okay, so as you can see, I mean, these whole genome duplication, they look like very rare events, like every 100, maybe 200 million years. I mean, depending on various properties like the type of reproduction of the organisms. But okay, so in any case, they look like quite rare. yet, in fact, in practice, they are very frequent. So, for instance, in human, we know that about 4% of miscarriages are due to this tetraploidization. And there are even newborns that that are fully tetraploids, so they actually live a few months up to, I think there are examples of newborns that can live 2 years while being completely tetraploid. So it's very frequent on the you know, from single organisms. Obviously, it brings a lot of trouble to this individual. So it's a long way to go from this genetic accident to you know, a new branch in eukaryotes, but this happens.
They're also easy to isolate in the lab. If you take a primary mammalian cell line that is diploid and sort on DNA content, you can easily get
tetraploids. Yeah. So the basic thing is that, you know, at every replication, you can, if you have a, you know, segregation. If you have a problem in segregating the two copies of your genome, you end up with a tetraploid cells, and typically it's fine.
So we know that it's not just duplication of one chromosome.
So this happens also. I mean, we know, you know, triploidy in humans, so you can have just a single chromosome. We don't know, so this is possible. I would say even likely that there was also, you know, duplication of single chromosomes. This is very, it's much more difficult to prove because it's, you know, a small part of the genome. And also, when people will argue that, you know, the nice thing, and we'll come back to that, when you duplicate the whole genomes, in principle, everybody's happy because you don't run into this imbalance expression of genes. I'll come back to that to discuss this aspect, because it's, I think there is a lot to discuss, but obviously you don't, at least you don't, in principle, you don't have this imbalance problem. Well, I mean, you know, triploidy is very frequent, so there are certain chromosomes that we can live with in
but at least in
triplicates,
at least to maintain it stably.
Yeah.
Certainly in the fungi, and most famously in the case you have shown here, the comparison between Cerevisiae and Lactis, for example, it's very clear it's a whole genome duplication.
Yeah.
I think in terms of occurrence, there's a single chromosome duplication should be much easier, because we only need a means of segregation.
Yeah.
And actually, I think in many external evolution, when you give them stress, then you will have a lot of single chromosome duplication.
Or telomeric crossovers, where you have long chunks of duplicated segments also.
Mm.
But those aren't.
I was saying it might be easy to do a whole duplication. I thought that was where we were going.
More survival.
More survival.
I mean, I think more survival. And I'm not sure whether that's, and I don't know whether that's true, that it's easier to duplicate a single chromosome. So certainly, and if you take mammalian cells and stain them for DNA and fact sort things out, it's very difficult to isolate things that will grow even for a single generation with 10% more DNA, but it's very easy to get things that will grow with double the DNA.
Yes, but I don't know, because in yeast, that's easy, even with extra copies of chromosomes.
Well, and then you're right, you just need to segregate your chromosomes.
That's right, and this segregation gives you one extra chromosome.
Just to get one extra chromosome.
Okay. That's not the number of chromosomes.
The question is, I mean,
the mechanism by which it arises, but then what the consequences are.
The issue is, you know, the survivability, and we're obviously talking about very different scales here,
yeah.
Whether you're talking about one generation,
cell lines, yeah.
You know, as I am, or whether we're talking about what we see in evolution.
Depends on how frequently you need to get into meiosis. Extra chromosome can give you more problems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right. So, okay. So, as we said, you know, after whole genome duplications, almost all this initial redundancy is lost, but this takes times, 100 million years typically, and this is done more or less at random on each copy.
Is that, I haven't seen that before. Onologs? Did you make that up, or is that it is?
Sorry, what?
Onologs. I haven't seen that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, I did not introduce the name. So yes, yeah. So these paralogs coming from whole genome duplication, we now call them onologs, after Ono.
It's a horrible term.
It is.
It's gotten so confusing.
Because a twin with ortholog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The confusion with ortholog.
They are paralogs. But I will argue
like
that
more than person, it's just.
But what you mean is parallel different paralog losses.
Sorry, what?
Parallel
onologs are. I believe the definition of an onolog is a duplicated chromosome. It's the whole set of duplicated chromosomes after whole genome duplication. Isn't that what distinguishes an onolog from a normal paralog? I don't think anybody uses onolog as a normal synonym for paralog.
No, I mean, for me,
I think in the literature, onologs is just a paralog coming from whole genome duplication. And as we will see, it's actually quite important to distinguish the mechanisms of duplications, because they are leads to all paralogs, but they are very different paralogs, so to speak. So, okay, so I think onologs, we'll stick with onologs for the time being. Okay, so in fact, so the issue is how to identify those onologs. And this is not, I mean, this is the reason why these debates lasted for 40 years. It's not trivial at all, since you know, as we said, if you lose 90% of the copies, then you retain just a few, and it's hard to convince yourself and even more the referees that these duplicates are not it's just small scale duplicates. Sounds like us. So the how the field changed, if you've not seen this already, is by comparing genomes that have diverged before the whole genome duplication events. So that's in yeast, indeed. So that's the whole genome duplication events that we had on the eukaryotic tree of life. So that's Cerevisia, and that's another lineage. This one has not duplicated its genome, and this one has. So basically, the extent Cerevisia genome looks like this. So you have maybe 5% of the genes that have duplicates somewhere else in the genome because of this whole genome duplication events. But obviously, surrounding those genes, there is nothing in common. So it's hard to make the case that this comes from this. So the basically what actually changed the field is by showing that you could map a single region of this non-duplicated lineage to two regions of this duplicated lineage by this almost perfect a 1-2 pattern where here the order of these genes are conserved.
Are there any differences in the spaces between genes? Is there much difference between the spaces between genes and those two organisms?
I don't know.
No.
I can't tell you. They're
intergenic region. There's no difference in intergenic distance between Clovermyces and Saccharomyces.
Yeah. I mean, they seem to have this pressure to reduce their genome anyway. All right, but this is the cartoon, so if you look at real data, it will look like this, at this sort of scale, but then the idea is to map, to show that you have this 2-to-1 map between the whole genomes. So these are the chromosomes of Kiwati, and you see that each region will map essentially in two colors, corresponding to different chromosomes of Cerevisia. And now you're not talking about 5% of the genes as duplicates, but 85 or so percent of all genes. So that would be very hard to achieve by just, you know, accumulating small scale duplications. You don't expect this almost perfect pattern.
That one question is a reference to Paul's talk, my ignorance, but do they have much gain of genes and loss of genes along the lines of what you were talking about in bacteria at all, or is that just not a factor?
In yeast?
So are you talking about horizontal?
No, I wasn't there last week.
Are you talking about
horizontal transfers and just gene loss? The whole thing was also gain of new genes through gene. Origin of mentioned as well.
But this has been very relatively recent. It's not a major factor. I mean, there are lineages where there's lots of gain of genes, especially through horizontal transfer, but not in this comparison between, typically over those time scales, the reorganization is such as that you wouldn't be able to map these back to inferable genome duplication.
Yeah, well, that's already 100 million years, so for yeast, you know, with this cell cycle or generation time that is quite fast, it's already a long time. That's all right. So that's what actually changed the way to try to prove and identify these homologs in genomes. obviously, for vertebrates, it's a bit more tricky. First, because we have two rounds of whole genome duplications, and they are also much more ancient. So, in fact, we've tried to, so there has been several attempts to identify those homologs in vertebrates, typically looking at just a single genome, typically human, and trying to find centennial or regions that somehow are enriched in paralogs, and so presumably homologs. So what we've tried to do to improve this is to actually adapt what had been done for yeast. But if you do it in vertebrates and you take a single invertebrate, in fact you miss quite a lot. So the idea was to try to gain statistical power by making multi-genome comparisons between multiple vertebrates and multiple invertebrates, and try to enhance your confidence that this particular pair is indeed an homolog pair or not.
What are the invertebrates?
Okay, so...
Did lamprey branch off?
Before? Yeah. Right. So that's lamprey is here. It's actually debated exactly where it stands. I think the last consensus is that probably it branches before, but that's not completely clear. Other people argue that it branches off between the two whole genome duplications. So we haven't used lamprey. So the invertebrates that we use are those. And the vertebrates are those. So by just comparing these 6x6 genomes and adapting more or less what had been done for yeast, but trying really to, you know, to quantify the confidence that we could have for each pair. So we have a complicated pipeline to do that. Probably today I really don't want to go into all this detail, but we can have some slides if you wish. At the end, we can discuss this in more detail. I just want to give you some of the results. So first, because we have this quantitative assessment, like a p-value, if you want, for each pair, we can, you know, put any cutoff that we want, and you know, define some analogs that we think are most likely true analogs up to you know, genes that are maybe or maybe not analogs. And the gene families that we get are completely consistent with these two rounds of whole genome mutation. There are hardly or very few gene families that expand beyond four analogs. Okay, and
could you explain what is an individual analog versus an analog pair?
Okay, so that, you know, in order to define analogs, you need to find another one, so you need to find pairs. Okay, so that's the number of pairs that we, with these criteria, that we identified. This corresponds to a number of individual analogs, because each one can be involved in different pairs. and then you from these pairs you can build up families, analog families. Okay.
I'm still confused. Sorry.
Yeah.
Why is an individual analog twice the number of pairs?
What are individual analogs as opposed to analog pairs?
Because most of them are just two, you know. When you see the gene families, most of them have two analogs. So that comes from this. So obviously, the gene families with two genes, you have twice the number of genes as pairs.
So I mean, your analogs are what's in the column individual analogs.
Right.
Right. And you're clustering those into families, and you're telling us the size of families to the
Yes, point. That's right.
The question is, what is an analog pair?
So analog pairs is how you identify them. So in order to prove that this particular gene is an analog, you need to find another, at least another one somewhere else that makes an analog pair.
So you're saying if all analogs were analog, if all analogs were in family size two,
which is almost
the analog pairs would be double the, the analog pairs would be exactly half the size of individual analogs. So the reason there are more analog pairs than half the number of individual analogs is that some are family size three or four or five.
Yeah.
And what is your criteria for finding an analog pair?
So this is on quantifying this centeny with themselves and with invertebrates, and doing it for multiple invertebrates just to gain statistical power in the claim that this particular pair is or not an analog.
You have cutoffs, you have...
Yes, so you have cutoffs. If you want, we can leave this for the end, and I can show you the details. All this is published, so you can definitely...
But this is why this term gets very confusing. I mean, you're talking about two whole genome duplications.
Yes.
So what now is an analog?
An analog is an analog coming from whole genome duplication.
Okay, but there's two over here and two over here.
Yes. So we don't...
And so if one of these disappeared and one of these disappeared, those analogs now? Because they are analogs from the first genome duplication.
Yes. No, you're right. So we cannot distinguish the two whole genome duplications. So we've tried this. We've tried hard, but we cannot distinguish them apart. So we don't know.
You're calling an analog, an analog pair, any heterologous genes for which you have any evidence of syntony with other heterologous genes.
Yes.
And you can't split them up because you can't make sure duplications are close enough so they have a resolution.
That's what we assume. That's what we assume. We've really tried that, and I don't think we can.
What fraction of total paralogous pairs are there? Are they ono pairs?
I'll come to that. Okay, and what we could show is that, you know, indeed by looking at multiple invertebrates, you actually gain statistical power, and in fact, there are many invertebrates or combination of invertebrate species that contribute to your identification of analogs. So these are all these. So these green things contribute to more than 2% of the total number of pairs here. And then you can also look at, so here are now the vertebrates, so you can look at consensus, so which are the onode pairs that are common to different vertebrates. And for instance, if you look at mammals or even human mouse and rats, you see that obviously we have many of those in common. Okay, so anyway, if you're interested by looking at this, you can also, because we have this quantitative approach, you can even set up your own threshold. So if you think that it's not the correct threshold that we apply, the numbers are available, and there is a you know, website where you can put your own threshold and recalculate somehow your gene families to make it more strict or less strict if you want. And the sort of result page for one, you know, so you query a gene. Here is the gene we query, and that's what you get. So depending on the different criteria, so those are defined, you know, arbitrary genes, but you can define your own if you want. And here you see we have families with two analogs, but typically what happens is that they might come in tandem somehow. So these analogs may have been retained in a region, in two different regions. So you have copies of this gene and copy of this gene in this region and copy of these genes nearby in the same region. So that's the reason why you end up with a bunch of genes corresponding to different regions. These are two analogs of family two, but you can also, if you relax a bit the criteria, you end up with more.
Those criteria, do they have something to do? I mean, the criteria that you're using, do they have to do with the number of analogs that you find, or the distance between them?
It's like a p-value. So it's a p-value. It's the chance that this is just a pure chance, you know, the chance that these guys are, the chance that you're wrong, basically, that, you know, you pretend, you claim that this pair is an analog, but in fact, just by pure chance, this, you know, they could be in this sort of centini arrangement. So that's the sort of p-value.
No, I understand that, but I mean, when you say this centini arrangement, is it more than just on the same chromosome, or?
Yeah, it's genome-wide, yeah. So basically, you know, you randomize your genome, and then you look at the chance that...
I understand that, but I mean, I should read the paper, we can talk later.
There's a criteria that there's the same order as centini. Does it matter if there's intervening genes, or...
So maybe I should... And this, so unlike in yeast, so in yeast you can really look at the order, so it's called the micro centini, so as in the picture I was showing, so you really look at the order. In vertebrates, presumably it's because this is much more ancient whole genome duplication, and because we also have these two, you don't have a strict conservation of order. So basically we look at local enrichment, so we look at regions, because you have, you know, all these inversions locally in genome, so the order is pretty messed up. But still, you can evaluate the chance that, you know, these guys are in some close neighborhood, both in this region and in this region, and this is not just happening by chance. So you can really quantify this. So this is how we do it, but there is no strict order requirement.
Did you try reconstructing ancestral genomes? Did you see any benefit to that?
Yes, we tried. So it's not in the paper, but we've sort of done it, yes. We can map pretty much the whole genome, which seems to, you know, reinforce this idea that indeed there was two rounds of whole genome duplications, because so far here, the initial idea, because typically this is what people have done initially, is try to reconstruct the ancestral genome and then map the two genomes like in yeast. So that's kind of how you want to prove that there was indeed a whole genome duplication. We said, okay, we don't really want to prove this anymore. We'd like to design a quantitative method to make sure that this particular pair is or not an analog. So we try to address this question. But in principle, then you can go back and try to reconstruct the genome. This is not yet in this paper. Okay, so now I'll come to the different types of duplicates. Obviously, you have whole genome duplications, as I described, but you also have small-scale duplications. And in fact, it has been known for quite some time, so actually before we got into the field, that there was very striking results. So it's as if you have, for instance, in human, if you take the 20,000 human genes, about half of them have been duplicated by small-scale duplicates, and between a quarter and a third of them by whole genome duplications. But as you realize, the intersection is very small. So it's as if you had predefined families that will tend to expand by small-scale duplicates or by whole genome duplications. And I mean, immediately when you see this, I think it hints to the fact that everything cannot be just adaptation, because obviously it really depends a lot on the sort of mechanisms that led to the duplications, whether you will retain or not this gene. So the same gene, if you make a small-scale duplicate, you will never retain it, and vice versa. Some other families, after whole genome duplications, you will never retain those copies. So it cannot just be adaptation at the selection level. There must be constraints due to these underlying duplication mechanisms. And I think
there's a lot of ascertainment bias, right? Because most of the single copy duplicates are extremely young. So some are 100% identical, so they can't even be fixed in the species. So you'll just get something that...
Yeah, well, yes. No, you're right. But no, you're right.
We can prove this with humans now, since we have a lot of human genomes.
No, you're right. But I don't think here we're talking about CNV or things like that. We're just talking about small-scale duplicates. Obviously, some are very recent, but many are also quite ancient, even at the origin of vertebrates and before that. So this is why we have this long,
These points, by the way, apply to lots of microbial eukaryotes as well.
Not just fungi, but
also I don't remember if you were here, but the gene families I mentioned today, they fall very much into these same kinds of.
So I think this is a very striking observation, I think. And in terms of function also, it was noticed that you have enrichment, if you do the GO term, let's say, you have enrichments in GO term for SSD that are different than from analog. So anything like linked to the immune or system or the sensory response will be strongly enriched for SSD.
I have a question, maybe I'm just not getting it, but I thought you said only 10% of the analogs were retained anyway,
yes.
So it seems like that's actually
bigger.
More, yes.
Over
so,
the minute.
Yeah, so if you do the calculation, you see that it's due to the two rounds. So two rounds, at the end, you get 25% or so. So that's okay. That's the...
Okay, but that's still not hugely far off the expectation, the amount of overlap.
Or yes, no, it is. So no, because you know this cover. So 20,000 is the total. So this cover almost all genes, up to. I mean, you have to make the calculation, but there are just a few thousand genes that have neither SSD nor whole genome duplicates. And if you do a partition on this number, the overlap would be much larger. So there is definitely something quite clear that this. There are two types of genes, so to speak. Some that tend to have expanded their families by SSD, other by expanding by WGD.
Now, I mean, 98, 18 plus 7, 71, 10 there is a large fraction. You know, that's a very dramatic lack of overlap.
Yeah, I know it's quite clear. All right, so there is indeed this antagonist retention pattern between these two types of duplicates, and that was known already. So because we came with this, looking at gene families that have these mutations and deleterious mutation, we look at the observed bias, not just on one pathways that we discussed earlier, but just on all a whole human genome. And what you see, so if you take, if you say, okay, about a third, or you can do the same thing with a more strict criteria, 25% of human genes are analogs, but the result is the same. What you see is that when you look at families related to disease, like cancer, dominant negative disease, oncogenes, the proportion are almost... inverted. You can also look at these gene families that have autoinhibitory domains, so that they are genes. So typically, you'll find them in signaling pathways.
Sorry, what are the two columns?
Okay, so the first column, the darker one, is the fraction of homologs, and the other one is just the complement, non-homologs.
What's okay? The horizontal line?
The horizontal line is a separate. Homologs that have also SSD or CNV, here, or homologs that are none. No SSD, no CNV. And that's the same here. So you see that this is larger than the, this is a larger part than this, and here is the other way around. Here it's a larger and smaller. This is the same story as the small overlap before.
What is susceptibility to this? Deleterious mutations, what's that?
Okay, so that's this gene family. So here you just take the genes that are known to be oncogenes rare use criteria. So definitely these genes will be considered as unknown actually to be oncogenes. And from in this subset of genes, you will find that almost two-thirds of those have retained homologs. If you look at genes that have this auto inhibition domain, so there are genes, there are typically these genes in active and inactive form. So they are typically in the cell, so the protein is typically in the cell in its inactive form. And this is because you typically have auto inhibitory domains that mask some binding sites, and then some signal occurs and you have some conformational change that make it active. So these genes are really prone to dominant mutations because this mutation will more likely than for other genes disrupt this auto inhibition and leads to constitutively active genes.
What's your data set on that? Is that the top one?
The data set is about 500 genes. Now we've...
What's your measure of susceptibility to deleterious mutations? Mike's question.
Okay. So this is the here they are none. It's this category is just genes that are known to have a autoinhibitory domain.
Yeah, fine.
Yes, and these are generally known to be prone to dominant mutations, but there is no measure of that. It's just here, I'm just taking this category of genes.
These are just categories that are known.
Yeah.
With vague known. That
hotline
is not a measure of that,
up to here, if you want, that's definitely in the category of prone to deleterious mutation, okay? And here, these guys, they're all also known to be prone to deleterious mutation, but it's not really a measure of that.
So I'm just curious about the definition of the categorization of autoinhibition. I haven't actually heard that as a defining term before, and it looks like 75% of the proteins that are defined as in your genus autoinhibitory are also associated with cancer, and that seems odd. I mean,
that's the case.
I don't believe it. That sounds like a sort of annotation artifact of where people have looked at the. I can't believe that 75% of the proteins with autoinhibitory domains are in a significant way associated with cancer.
Well, I think they are. So this category, this is really data mining by us. So, and we've looked at papers one by one. So I think they're all demonstrated.
Kinases with autoinhibitory domains, and only in the weakest sense would you say that they're all associated with cancer.
Yeah, but so in
In
that case, they might not be included there. Okay, so this we can.
So we may be more likely to find them.
Okay,
when
so
we look
no.
at cancer genes and identify, they'd be more likely to identify the autoinhibitory.
Okay, so here it's here it's really based on demonstrated autoinhibition bias. You know, some domain of the protein, and we also extended this class of genes by adding a priori all genes with domains that are known to be autoinhibitory. So then you expand your data set up to 800 or so genes. Doesn't really change the rest of the graph, but okay, you can expand or restrict these criteria, but. Okay, so the bottom line is definitely these genes with autoinhibition domains, they have definitely retained a lot of these homologs.
Sorry, can I just ask about the two columns again? So the non-homolog ones is the ones where I don't have a duplicate, and then you distinguish it between the small step duplicate and the whole genome duplicate, but if you don't have a duplicate, so the other one is the one where you look at duplicates and then you look at whether the gene family comes from a small scale duplication or a whole genome duplication. Right.
So each gene can have, you know, either monologs or SSD or none.
Yeah.
So that's what in there. But you know, here I don't really want to focus on this part. But that's related to the small overlap, in fact, that we observed earlier. Okay, so in a sense, I mean, what we all this suggests is that, you know, the more susceptible to deleterious mutation, and in particular dominant deleterious mutation, I'll show you this in a second, the more expanded these genes families have been through whole genome duplications. Yes?
Going back. So these categories seem somewhat nested, right? So the oncogenes oncogenes. So if you exclude your very last column from the oncogene column,
Yes.
We would basically bring...
Okay, so the very last column is actually an intersection between this one and this one. So this is autoinhibition and oncogenes.
If you subtract that bias in the last column, will there be any effect left in your oncogene column? Does this completely count for everything, or is there some...
No, because that's only 100 genes or so. That's the intersection between this guy and this guy, and that's about 100 genes, so you subtract, you'll still have a very clear enrichment. Anyway, you look, you know, no matter how you look at it, it's very strong. If you can calculate the p-value, you'll see it's really striking.
I mean, you know, those numbers are going to, in the red bar, it's going to be roughly 500 and 300, and you're going to subtract 100 from the left and 10 from the right.
No, so that there is something. I think we may argue about the reason, but definitely the data is there. One thing that is also very striking is that this enrichment is really related to dominance. So disease genes related to recessive disease, they have not been enriched in analogs. So that's what you see here, and dominant disease. You can also look at essential genes. So essential genes, it's a bit complicated because you can have genes that are both essential and dangerous. So essential, again, it's you need at least one functional copy to be viable. And dangerous is when you mutate just one allele, you're likely to be in trouble. So some are both. You need at least one copy, but if you mutate just one also, you're in trouble. So if you remove from the essential gene the dangerous one, then you see that essential genes, so related to susceptible to recessive mutations, they have not been enriched in analog. The p-value is non-significant. So I think this is really, so the idea is really the dominance of this mutation that.
Is that true for analogs as distinct from paralogs? I mean, almost by definition, paralogs are less likely to be essential in your
definition. You're right. I'll come to back. I'm not sure I will go to the end, but at the end I'll discuss this sort of
thing. Because, I mean, the claim you're trying to make here, I think it's an interesting one, is that relative to duplication by whatever means that gives rise to paralogy, that analogs are associated with this category of dangerous, and presumably that has something to do with what it is that you need to duplicate. I mean, if you're duplicating a signaling pathway, in order to have any function, you really need to duplicate many members of it, whereas if it's a adhesive surface antigen, you can actually gain some function by duplicating.
Okay, I think the underlying, I mean, we may argue about the underlying reason. I think the data, this we cannot really argue. That's really what the data says. But I'll come to...
So how much of this is just due to the fact that analogs are just older? So you could do this with just single copy duplicates of different ages.
Yes.
The analogs are so old that they probably become subfunctionalized in many cases, or neofunctionalized.
Yes.
So doesn't quite separate out just the age.
Yes, no, I see what you mean. Yeah. So actually in this PLOS 2014, we discussed this age of SSD, and you can look at the number. I don't have the slides here, but you can look at this. And I think to some extent it's there is something to it, yes. The age, the problem is the numbers. The numbers are too small, so it won't really change the sort of mechanisms, but you're right that there is something to the age, exactly, presumably by, you know, subfunctionalization that had much more time to occur.
Sorry, Mike, can you remind me, because I can see how the age affects the essentiality of the essentiality distribution, because older ones, they become subfunctionalization, and also they become essential. But why that will make them more dangerous and having this kind of function? Because say, because when they become essential, so their mutant also become gain of function.
Oh, I'm not thinking too deeply. I'm just thinking that, you know, younger duplicate genes are going to be more redundant.
Yeah, no, you're right.
They're already non-essential. They're not going to be even fixed in the species.
So it speaks to the essentiality side, but not necessarily the dangerous side.
I mean, do you have an argument for why dangerous should be selected for? Is, you know, are we?
Yeah, I'll come to that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's a term that maybe you mean something as well.
Is there any data showing how dangerous they are? There's a dependency on how many copies there are.
Yes. And there is, so the more dangerous, the more copies have been retained,
So related to the age thing, maybe you're going to talk about this, but Dietmar Tautz had a paper many years ago on the, he looked at all known cancer genes and he did a giant phylogeny across the metazoa and tried to figure out where the genes that are related to cancer go back in metazoa. I guess maybe you're not going to tell us about the link.
Okay.
Because it might be related. It seems to me it might be related. There's some ideas in this paper that might be relevant.
Okay, so let me try to answer your question. So I'll present you some idea about, you know, the reason of this kind of striking observation. So for the moment, I'll just show some cartoon. So it's gonna be just as a, you know, qualitative level, and then, you know, we've also done much more quantitative population genetics models. So I'll go to that very briefly. And more recently, we've also done data-driven models. So where you know, don't put any first principle population genetics model in, and trying to extract some causal relations between different genomic properties without a priori. So I'm not sure how much I would cover, but okay. So let just give me the cartoon, the small idea. So the obviously we'll be comparing whole genome duplication and small scale duplication, and how these genes will be retained. So in the first scenario, there is just one gene in a single individual of a population. So this is the population of n individual. Each one is a genome. One individual will duplicate one gene, that's a SSD. Or in the other scenario, one individual will duplicate its whole genome. So intuitively, and I think we can all agree on this, after a small-scale duplicate, what will happen is rather intuitive. So depending on the type of effect of these mutations or having double copies, it can sometimes be beneficial to have two copies. And if it's really beneficial, it will be fixed in the whole population if the conditions are right. And that's how you can retain this innovation. That's quite rare. Most often, what happens is that this, you know, you'll have mutations, and at some point, you may have mutations that will just lose the function of one of the copy, and then basically you'll go back to the initial situation and the initial population. Alternatively, you can also, instead of deleting the gene, if you want, you can also eliminate the individual if the mutation in this particular copies were strongly deleterious. So we are just, you know, these dangerous genes will be in this category where the mutations will very likely unfavor the individual. But then it's more or less, the result is more or less the same. You're back to the initial situation. So that's fairly intuitive, and somehow, and as you can see, I mean, in this, after this SSD, the only way you will retain a small scale duplicate if it's beneficial somehow.
So what?
At least if the population is right. Sorry?
What? So is column A, are you being retained for dosage reasons? Where does subfunctionalization come in here? Is that embedded?
Yeah, so yes. At some point, there must be some reason.
Subfunctionalization
isn't necessarily
beneficial.
No, it might not. No. Subfunctionalization.
That is the subfunctionalization, right?
No.
Or it could be.
No, subfunctionalization will be now.
Preservation by degenerative mutations.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So here it will be really beneficial, whether for dosage, as you change environment, and it's useful now to have twice as many copies of these genes or higher expression, or maybe you just pick up mutations that gives you new functions, can be neofunctionalization. In any case, that's quite rare, but that's basically the only way you can really expand your family after SSD, at least if the population is large enough. If the population is small, we'll go back to this. So somehow this has to change after whole genome modification. So in fact, the bottom line is there is one main difference, but that's kind of critical. After whole genome modification, as we said, so whole genome modification, they are quite frequent, but they are eliminated typically. Sometimes some organisms after whole genome modification can remain and you can map them on the tree of life. So what happened is that these individuals, they must have undergone speciation. So whole genome modifications, they need to come with speciation events. The reason is that these individuals that underwent this whole genome modification, well, typically they cannot crossbreed with their relatives. So in fact they can, but the descendants is typically infertile. So the only way these few individuals can have some hope to still impact the tree of life is by starting a new species somehow. So so this whole genome duplication, when they are fixed, they need to go through speciation. So just as a sign. So if you crossbreed tetraploids, so after whole genome duplication and diploids, you get a triploids organism, and that's how, for instance, you make seedless fruits. So the organism is typically viable but infertile. So from an evolutionary point of view, it needs to be treated as two different species. So now the reasoning we made before, we will just do exactly the same, but relative not to the initial population, but to this new population. And the difference is that because whole genome modification induced speciation or made to go through speciation, all genes have been fixed already in this. So no matter which genes they are, they're all fixed in this new population. So this fixation of duplicates that we encountered before, that we could not fix when the mutations were deleterious, we kind of bypassed this. So now, if you apply the same reasoning, nothing changed much for the initial column, except that beneficial mutation will be, selection by adaptation will be kind of difficult, if not impossible, if the population is very small. So this is essentially, this I think we can essentially ignore in practice. And the other two scenarios are the same. So most mutations will lead to a loss of function, and so you will get rid of these duplicates rather easily. There will be some more complication afterwards that we can discuss. And in the last column, so these individuals that had the bad luck, so to speak, to mutate one of their multiple copies of oncogenes will be eliminated from the population. And as a result, since the population is just made of the surviving individuals, these genes will be retained in the population. Okay, so that's the cartoon. Obviously, you need to add a bit more to make it work quantitatively, but that's the basic idea.
Wait,
yeah.
Could you just go over that last one more time?
Yeah. So the idea here is that because of the speciation, all genes,
yeah,
dangerous or not, are fixed in this population already. So you don't, okay. And now the reasoning is the same. So if
each little railroad car there, that's an individual.
Sorry, what?
It's like three individuals per train.
Yeah, yeah, three individuals here with the two genes.
Three individuals.
And this individual here had the bad idea to mutate one oncogene. So obviously he'll be he'll, you know, either this individual or his descendants will be unfavored, so essentially eliminated from this new population. So as a result, the population will tend to retain those dangerous yet non-mutated.
That's a gain of function. That bad individual. That was a gain of function.
Yes, because you see, the point is you have these four copies, so in order to have some deleterious effect, this needs to be a dominant effect. So the mutation needs to be somehow dominant. If it's recessive, you're here. So then you will just lose the function.
Why wouldn't that happen with these oncogenes? Why wouldn't? Because wouldn't you be safe once you got over to the left?
Yes. So obviously, I mean, once you're here, you can expect to go back here and so.
What's
so,
the here? Why have they turned black? I'm missing.
Here?
Yeah.
What they turn black is just the genes that I'm looking at. I mean, just the. So here we just, you know, this is this gene that has a mutation. Either this is beneficial, neutral, or deleterious. I'm just looking at a specific gene, but it applies to any.
But you're locus. Saying it didn't mutate?
Well, it did mutate in this individual. And as a result, it killed him. Okay, so the rest of the population was lucky and didn't make any mutation in these genes. But still, in the population, the problem remains. Okay, so obviously, Mike says, "Well, okay, but why these guys cannot just go there and then have a loss of function mutation exactly in this position and then eliminate this gene?" So in fact, it occurs. But there is some bias, and I will show you that, you know, so basically.
So you're assuming that the deleterious mutation has the same effect in the context of four copies as it does in two copies, right? Correct?
Yeah, the dominant mutations, you expect them to be dominant even if you have four copies.
So that may not always be the case.
Well, you know, these genes, again, I mean, you know, when you mutate these SYNG9 genes, you know, you have a RAS or RAS-related genes that become, you know, 100 times more active. So if you have three other copies that are fine, won't change the outcome. I mean, you're really sick. So, yeah, so these mutations, they are really making these genes much more... much more active and hence very deleterious.
Can we go back to why you dismissed A? Because that's, and I assume then you're including neofunctionalization and subfunctionalization in A.
Okay, so subfunctionalization, I would say, comes on the longer run. So, as Mike suggested, so these guys obviously they can go there and have loss of function, and then you lose this oncogene, and this occurs most of the time. So, this is not that. You know, dangerous genes, they all go this way and they're all conserved because not, you know, 100% of these genes are retained four copies. In fact, most of them have lost their copies. But there is a small bias. If you look at, you know, any genes, you have 90% of chance to lose its copies. If you look at oncogenes, you have 80% of chance to lose its copies. So it's still what... So. The outcome is most often this route, but because of this route, you can bias somehow the elimination of those copies. So there are genes that are more difficult to get rid of after whole genome duplication than others.
So you're saying dangerous genes are more likely to subfunctionalize than genes that aren't?
Yeah, so.
Are unlikely to subfunctionalize? Is that what I'm
saying? I guess you could say this. And this is because, you know, these genes are retained longer somehow in the genome. So at some point, obviously, they need to, they're still dangerous, but somehow, you know, there will be other mutations that will be able to...
You say they have longer time periods of functional lines, is that...
Yeah, I guess so. You could claim this. So genes that they can only have loss on function, so eventually, you know, you will just lose them. Unless, indeed, you have mutations that make them becoming more essential, so now you cannot get rid of them. So obviously by subfunctionalization, but that's not really in this cartoon. Obviously, if you want, in the quantitative model, you need to add all this. So on longer time scale, you have this subfunctionalization that will, you know, make these genes become
You're not making the argument essential. If you're not dangerous, you don't subfunctionalize.
No.
Okay, that would be in the...
I'm making the argument that if you're dangerous, you have this extra route that will somehow change the numbers. In fact, it won't change the whole picture. So that is, you get rid of those genes. 80% of the time, these dangerous genes, they are lost. And they are lost by this route, obviously. But because you also have a significant fraction of mutations that leads to elimination of this individual, they tend to be retained longer in the population. And at the end, you get this bias. So I think I have very few minutes, so I'll just try to give you really an outline of all this is published so that you can look at it. So you can make proper population genetic model of this cartoon, okay? I really won't go in the details, but you can even look at very, very simple models. So here is a deterministic model. And basically the only difference is, so we will solve this model. We can even solve it exactly in the asymptotic limit. And the only difference is the fraction of individuals that are duplicated at time zero. So if this is a whole genome duplication, as we said, because there is speciation, so all the individuals have the duplication, okay? So in that case, this epsilon will become 1. Epsilon is the fraction of individuals in the population with this duplicate. If it's small-scale duplicates, only 1 out of n individuals will have this duplicate. So then the equations, they are the same, okay? It's just the initial condition that changes. And it, for this very simple deterministic model, you can even solve it, and you can see that, in fact, the fraction of duplicates retention, either after whole genome duplication or small-scale duplicate, depends on the fraction of these dominant mutations. Okay, so if a significant fraction of these mutations are dominant, you will bias it. It won't be 100%, of course, far from it, but it's enough to show very significant statistics at the end. This is in the deterministic limit. You can do it, you can look at the proper way, looking at finite size effect, population size effect. And what you find is that for whole genome duplication, there is actually very little of an effect because, as we said, the population is very small in any case. And so you have a retention of these duplicates depending on the dangerousness of their mutations. And for SSD, you have essentially no effect, except for very small populations. So if the populations become smaller and smaller, at the end, even SSD can be fixed in the population by drift, in fact. So obviously, if you have an SSD, if the population is very small, you make an SSD. If it's fixed in the population, then you're back to the previous scenario. So SSD eventually will reach exactly the same curve as analogs, and you could expect that you could also enrich your genome by SSD if it happens at bottleneck periods, for instance. And I think this is probably the case, although we haven't really looked at this in detail. So this is blah, blah. Okay, so maybe you give me a few minutes, or we should stop here? I don't know.
Probably should stop it.
Okay.
So
okay. So that's
two more sentences.
Two more sentence?
One more sentence.
Okay, so just quickly, so what I show you is this link, okay? In the field, in fact, there was other suggestions, in particular the fact that onologs are dosage balanced, okay? So we look at this in great detail. Okay, the bottom line is that it's complicated. Definitely there is a small tendency of genes in complexes to be retained after whole genome mutations, but as you see, if you look at permanent complexes, the other way around. So in fact, I think this is not the case. We look at this in detail. In particular, we could show that obviously some of these effects are indirect. So if you can, the dosage balance effect we could show is largely mediated by this susceptibility to mutations. I skip the methods and I can show you the result. So here, or even over there. So the bias that is seen between genes involved in complex and their retention as onologs is mainly caused by their susceptibility to mutations. And if you look at the alternative models where you assume that the deleterious mutation are the main cause, you see that the fact to be involved or not in complex has essentially no effect. So that's for this, and obviously we would like to add not just three properties to discriminate between two hypotheses, but in principle we'd like to address this question without a priori, without model, without we'd just like to see what the data are saying, and trying to see all the different factors that could affect this onologue retention. So for this, we'll develop other approaches that I will go into detail. But I can just show you
I think I just wanted to make sure that you could tell us the main things that you're thinking about, since today is your last day.
No, I'm leaving next week.
Ah, okay.
Next week.
So we have time to...
Okay. I just want to flash the sort of result that we have. So this is unpublished. So now, you know, we don't take just two or three properties. We take as many as we want. So here it's based on these 20,000 human genes, and you look at the different properties of these genes, and you try to reconstruct these causal networks relating those properties. And as you can see, so onologs, they're here. They are really much related to this susceptibility to dominant mutation, disease, autoinhibition, and in fact not directly related to essentiality or complex or so on. Obviously there are some indirect effects, basically through mutations as we suggest. And okay, and you can look at how robust this is to adding more properties, and this is fairly robust actually. But obviously there are many more interesting relations here, not only with onologs. For instance, you see that recent SSD, that's what we discussed earlier. Obviously recent SSD will make these gene families unlikely to be involved in disease, because you have this duplicate backup, basically. The same for essentiality. So recent SSD, you can... But here it's just proof from the data. You don't assume anything as first principle or whatever. And you see that the fact of being essential is also oppositely caused by having recent SSD. So if you have recent SSD, you're unlikely to be essential any longer, because you have this backup. Okay, and probably you can also look at the gene expression level or conservation, and there are many interesting relations to explore. Okay, so I'm sorry for the time, but you asked quite a few questions. Okay.